or Peggotty's, and slipped to my feet at the bedside. It was Mr. Murdstone's hand, and he kept it on my arm as he said, "What's this? Clara, my love, have you forgotten? Firmness, my dear." "I'm very sorry, Edward," said my mother. "I meant to be very good, but I am so uncomfortable."
"Indeed," he answered. "That's a bad hearing so soon, Clara."
"I say it's very hard I should be made so now," returned my mother, pouting, "and it is very hard, isn't it?" He drew her to him, whispered in her ear, and kissed her. I knew as well when I saw my mother's head lean down upon his shoulder and her arm touch his neck, I knew as well that he could mould her pliant nature into any form he chose, as I know now that he did it.
"Go you below, my love," said Mr. Murdstone. "David and I will come down together. My friend," turning a darkening face on Peggotty, when he'd watched my mother out and dismissed her with a nod and a smile, "do you know your mistress's name?"
"She's been my mistress a long time, sir," answered Peggotty. "I ought to it."
"That's true," he answered. "But I thought I heard you, as I came upstairs, address her by a name that is not hers. She has taken mine, you know. Will you remember that?"
Peggotty, with some uneasy glances at me, curtsied herself out of the room without replying, seeing, I suppose, that she was expected to go, and had no excuse for remaining. When we two were left alone, he shut the door, and, sitting on a chair, and holding me standing before him, looked steadily into my eyes. I felt my own attracted no less steadily to his. As I recall our being opposed thus, face to face, I seem again to hear my heart beat fast and high.
"David," he said, making his lips thin by pressing them together, "if I have an obstinate horse or dog to deal with, what do you think I do?"
"I don't know."
"I beat him."
I'd answered in a kind of breathless whisper, but I felt in my silence that my breath was shorter now.
"I make him wince and smart. I say to myself, I'll conquer that fellow, and if it were to cost him all the blood he had, I should do it. What is that upon your face?"
"Dirt," I said. He knew it was the mark of tears as well as I. But if he'd asked the question 20 times, each time with 20 blows, I believe my baby heart would have burst before I would have told him so.
"You have a good deal of intelligence for a little fellow," he said, with a grave smile that belonged to him. "And you understand me very well, I see. Wash that face, sir, and come down with me."
He pointed to the washing-stand, which I had made out to be like Mrs. Gummidge, and motioned me with his head to obey him directly. I had little doubt then, and I have less doubt now, that he would have knocked me down without the least compunction if I'd hesitated.
"Clara, my dear," he said, when I'd done his bidding, and he walked me into the parlour with his hands still on my arm, "you will not be made uncomfortable any more, I hope. We shall soon improve our youthful humours."
God help me, I might have been improved for my whole life. I might have been made another creature, perhaps, for life, by a kind word at that season. A word of encouragement and explanation, of pity for my childish ignorance, of welcome home, of reassurance to me that it was home, might have made me dutiful to him in my heart henceforth, instead of in my hypocritical outside, and might have made me respect instead of hate him. I thought my mother was sorry to see me standing in the room so scared and strange, and that presently, when I stole to a chair, she followed me with her eyes more sorrowfully still, missing perhaps some freedom in my childish tread. But the word was not spoken, and the time for it was gone. We dined alone, we three together. He seemed to be very fond of my mother. I'm afraid I liked him none the better for that, and she was very fond of him. I gathered from what they said that an elder sister of his was coming to stay with them, and that she was expected that evening. I'm not certain whether I found out then or afterwards that, without being actively concerned in any business, he had some share in or some annual charge upon the profits of a wine merchant's house in London, with which his family had been connected from his great-grandfather's time, and in which his sister had a similar interest. But I may mention it in this place, whether or no. After dinner, when we were sitting by the fire, and I was meditating an escape to Peggotty without having the hardihood to slip away, lest it should offend the master of the house, a coach drove up to the garden gate, and he went out to receive the visitor. My mother followed him. I was timidly following her, when she turned round at the parlour door in the dusk, and taking me in her embrace, as she'd been used to do, whispered me to love my new father and be obedient to him. She did this hurriedly and secretly, as if it were wrong, but tenderly, and putting out her hand behind her, held mine in it, until we came near to where he was standing in the garden, where she let mine go and drew hers through his arm. It was Miss Murdstone who was arrived, and a gloomy-looking lady she was. Dark, like her brother, whom she greatly resembled in face and voice, and with very heavy eyebrows, nearly meeting over her large nose, as if, being disabled by the wrongs of her sex from wearing whiskers, she'd carried them to that account. She brought with her two uncompromising hard black boxes, with her initials on the lids in hard brass nails. When she paid the coachman, she took her money out of a hard steel purse, and she kept the purse in a very jail of a bag, which hung upon her arm by a heavy chain and shut up like a bite. I had never, at that time, seen such a metallic lady altogether as Miss Murdstone was. She was brought into the parlour with many tokens of welcome, and there formally recognised my mother as a new and near relation. Then she looked at me and said, "Is that your boy, sister-in-law?" My mother acknowledged me. "Generally speaking," said Miss Murdstone, "I don't like boys." "How do you do, boy?" Under these encouraging circumstances, I replied that I was very well, and that I hoped she was the same. With such an indifferent grace that Miss Murdstone disposed of me in two words, once manner. Having uttered which with great distinctness, she begged the favour of being shown to her room, which became to me from that time forth a place of awe and dread, wherein the two black boxes were never seen open or known to be left unlocked, and where, for I peeped in once or twice when she was out, numerous little steel fetters and rivets with which Miss Murdstone embellished herself when she was dressed generally hung upon the looking-glass in formidable array. As well as I could make out, she had come for good, and had no intention of ever going again. She began to help my mother next morning, and was in and out of the store closet all day, putting things to rights and making havoc in the old arrangements. Almost the first remarkable thing I observed in Miss Murdstone was her being constantly haunted by a suspicion that the servants had a man secreted somewhere on the premises. Under the influence of this delusion, she dived into the coal cellar at the most untimely hours, and scarcely ever opened the door of a dark cupboard without clapping it to again in the belief that she'd got him. Though there was nothing very airy about Miss Murdstone, she was a perfect lark in point of getting up. She was up, and, as I believe, to this hour looking for that man, before anybody in the house was stirring. Peggotty gave it as her opinion that she even slept with one eye open, but I couldn't concur in this idea, for I tried it myself after hearing the suggestion thrown out and found it couldn't be done. On the very first morning after her arrival, she was up and ringing her bell at cockcrow. When my mother came down to breakfast and was going to make the tea, Miss Murdstone gave her a kind of peck on the cheek, which was her nearest approach to a kiss, and said, "Now, Clara, my dear, I am come here, you know, to relieve you of all the trouble I can. You're much too pretty and thoughtless." My mother blushed but laughed, and seemed not to dislike this character, "to have any duties imposed upon you that can be undertaken by me. If you'll be so good as give me your keys, my dear, I'll attend to all this sort of thing in future." From that time, Miss Murdstone kept the keys in her own little jail all day, and under her pillow all night, and my mother had no more to do with them than I had. My mother did not suffer her authority to pass from her without a shadow of protest. One night, when Miss Murdstone had been developing certain household plans to her brother, of which he signified his approbation, my mother suddenly began to cry and said she thought she might have been consulted. "Clara," said Mr. Murdstone sternly, "Clara, I wonder at you." "Oh, it's very well to say you wonder, Edward," cried my mother, "and it's very well for you to talk about firmness, but you wouldn't like it yourself." Firmness, I may observe, was the grand quality on which both Mr. and Miss Murdstone took their stand. However, I might have expressed my comprehension of it at that time, if I'd been called upon. I nevertheless did clearly comprehend in my own way that it was another name for tyranny, and for a certain gloomy, arrogant devil's humour that was in them both. The creed, as I should state it now, was this: Mr. Murdstone was firm. Nobody in his world was to be so firm as Mr. Murdstone. Nobody else in his world was to be firm at all, for everybody was to be bent to his firmness. Miss Murdstone was an exception. She might be firm, but only by relationship and in an inferior and tributary degree. My mother was another exception. She might be firm, and must be, but only in bearing their firmness, and firmly believing there was no other firmness upon earth. "It's very hard," said my mother, "that in my own house..." "My own house?" repeated Mr. Murdstone. "Clara!" "Our own house, I mean," faltered my mother, evidently frightened. "I hope you must know what I mean, Edward. It's very hard that in your own house I may not have a word to say about domestic matters. I'm sure I managed very well before we were married." "There's evidence," said my mother, sobbing. "Ask Peggotty if I didn't do very well when I wasn't interfered with." "Edward," said Miss Murdstone, "let there be an end of this. I go tomorrow."
"Jane Murdstone," said her brother, "be silent. How dare you to insinuate that you don't know my character better than your words imply?"
"I'm sure," my poor mother went on at a grievous disadvantage, and with many tears, "I don't want anybody to go. I should be very miserable and unhappy if anybody was to go. I don't ask much. I'm not unreasonable. I only want to be consulted sometimes. I'm very much obliged to anybody who assists me, and I only want to be consulted as a mere form sometimes. I thought you were pleased once with my being a little inexperienced and girlish, Edward. I'm sure you said so, but you seem to hate me for it now, you're so severe."
"Edward," said Miss Murdstone again, "let there be an end of this. I go tomorrow." "Jane Murdstone," thundered Mr. Murdstone, "will you be silent? How dare you?"
Miss Murdstone made a jail delivery of her pocket handkerchief and held it before her eyes.
"Clara," he continued, looking at my mother, "you surprise me. You astound me.
Yes, I had a satisfaction in the thought of marrying an inexperienced and artless person, and forming her character, and infusing into it some amount of that firmness and decision of which it stood in need. But when Jane Murdstone is kind enough to come to my assistance in this endeavour, and to assume, for my sake, a condition something like a housekeeper's, and when she meets with a base return...
Oh, pray, pray, Edward, cried my mother, don't accuse me of being ungrateful. I'm sure I'm not ungrateful. No one ever said I was before. I have many faults, but not that. Oh, don't, my dear.
When Jane Murdstone meets, I say, he went on after waiting until my mother was silent, with a base return, that feeling of mine is chilled and altered.
Don't, my love, say that, implored my mother very piteously. Oh, don't, dear Edward, I can't bear to hear it. Whatever I am, I'm affectionate. I know I'm affectionate. I wouldn't say it if I wasn't certain that I am. Ask Peggotty. I'm sure she'll tell you I'm affectionate.
There is no extent of mere weakness, Clara, said Mr. Murdstone in reply, that can have the least weight with me. You lose breath.
Pray, let us be friends, said my mother. I couldn't live under coldness or unkindness. I'm so sorry. I have a great many defects, I know, and it's very good of you, Edward, with your strength of mind, to endeavour to correct them for me. Jane, I don't object to anything. I should be quite broken-hearted if you thought of leaving.
My mother was too much overcome to go on. Jane Murdstone, said Mr. Murdstone to his sister, any harsh words between us are, I hope, uncommon. It is not my fault that so unusual an occurrence has taken place tonight. I was betrayed into it by another. Nor is it your fault. You were betrayed into it by another. Pray, let us both try to forget it. And as this, he added, after these magnanimous words, is not a fit scene for the boy, David, go to bed. I could hardly find the door through the tears that stood in my eyes. I was so sorry for my mother's distress. But I groped my way out, and groped my way up to my room in the dark, without even having the heart to say good night to Peggotty, or to get a candle from her. When her coming up to look for me an hour or so afterwards woke me, she said that my mother had gone to bed poorly, and that Mr. and Miss Murdstone were sitting alone. Going down next morning rather earlier than usual, I paused outside the parlour door on hearing my mother's voice. She was very earnestly and humbly entreating Miss Murdstone's pardon, which that lady granted, and a perfect reconciliation took place. I never knew my mother afterwards to give an opinion on any matter without first appealing to Miss Murdstone, or without having first ascertained by some sure means what Miss Murdstone's opinion was, and I never saw Miss Murdstone when out of temper, she was infirm that way, move her hand towards her bag as if she were going to take out the keys and offer to resign them to my mother, without seeing that my mother was in a terrible fright. The gloomy taint that was in the Murdstone blood darkened the Murdstone religion, which was austere and wrathful. I've thought since that its assuming that character was a necessary consequence of Mr. Murdstone's firmness, which wouldn't allow him to let anybody off from the utmost weight of the severest penalties he could find any excuse for. Be this as it may, I well remember the tremendous visages with which we used to go to church, and the changed air of the place. Again, the dreaded Sunday comes round, and I file into the old pew first, like a guarded captive brought to a condemned service. Again, Miss Murdstone, in a black velvet gown, that looks as if it had been made out of a pall, follows close upon me. Then my mother. Then her husband. There is no Peggotty now, as in the old time. Again I listen to Miss Murdstone muttering the responses and emphasising all the dread words with a cruel relish. Again I see her dark eyes roll round the church when she says, "Miserable sinners," as if she were calling all the congregation names. Again I catch rare glimpses of my mother, moving her lips timidly between the two, with one of them muttering at each ear like low thunder. Again I wonder, with a sudden fear, whether it's likely that our good old clergyman can be wrong, and Mr. and Miss Murdstone right, and that all the angels in heaven can be destroying angels. Again, if I move a finger or relax a muscle of my face, Miss Murdstone pokes me with her prayer book and makes my side ache. Yes, and again, as we walk home, I note some neighbours looking at my mother, and at me, and whispering. Again, as the three go on arm in arm, and I linger behind alone, I follow some of those looks, and wonder if my mother's step be really not so light as I've seen it, and if the gaiety of her beauty be really almost worried away. Again, I wonder whether any of the neighbours call to mind, as I do, how we used to walk home together, she and I. And I wonder stupidly about that all the dreary, dismal day. There had been some talk on occasions of my going to boarding school. Mr. and Miss Murdstone had originated it, and my mother had, of course, agreed with them. Nothing, however, was concluded on the subject yet. In the meantime, I learnt lessons at home. Shall I ever forget those lessons? They were presided over nominally by my mother, but really by Mr. Murdstone and his sister, who were always present, and found them a favourable occasion for giving my mother lessons in that miscalled firmness which was the bane of both our lives. I believe I was kept at home for that purpose. I'd been apt enough to learn, and willing enough, when my mother and I had lived alone together. I can faintly remember learning the alphabet at her knee. To this day, when I look upon the fat black letters in the primer, the puzzling novelty of their shapes and the easy good nature of O and Q and S always seem to present themselves again before me as they used to do. But they recall no feeling of disgust or reluctance. On the contrary, I seem to have walked along a path of flowers as far as the crocodile book, and to have been cheered by the gentleness of my mother's voice and manner all the way. But these solemn lessons which succeeded those, I remember as the death blow at my peace, and a grievous daily drudgery and misery. They were very long, very numerous, very hard, perfectly unintelligible, some of them, to me, and I was generally as much bewildered by them as I believe my poor mother was herself. Let me remember how it used to be, and bring one morning back again. I come into the second-best parlour after breakfast with my books and an exercise book and a slate. My mother is ready for me, at her writing desk, but not half so ready as Mr. Murdstone in his easy chair by the window, though he pretends to be reading a book, or as Miss Murdstone sitting near my mother stringing steel beads. The very sight of these two has such an influence over me that I begin to feel the words I have been at infinite pains to get into my head all sliding away and going I don't know where. I wonder where they do go, by the by. I hand the first book to my mother. Perhaps it's a grammar, perhaps a history or a geography. I take a last drowning look at the page as I give it into her hand, and start off aloud at a racing pace while I've got it fresh. I trip over a word. Mr. Murdstone looks up. I trip over another word. Miss Murdstone looks up. I redden, tumble over half a dozen words, and stop. I think my mother would show me the book if she dared. But she does not dare. And she says softly, "Oh, Davy, Davy." "Now, Clara," says Mr. Murdstone, "be firm with the boy. Don't say, 'Oh, Davy, Davy,' that's childish. He knows his lesson, or he does not know it." "He does not know it," Miss Murdstone interposes awfully. "I'm really afraid he does not," says my mother. "Then you see, Clara," returns Miss Murdstone, "you should just give him the book back and make him know it." "Yes, certainly," says my mother. "That is what I intend to do, my dear Jane. Now, David, try once more, and don't be stupid." I obey the first clause of the injunction by trying once more, but am not so successful with the second, for I am very stupid. I tumble down before I get to the old place, at a point where I was all right before, and stop to think. But I don't think about the lesson. I can't. I think of the number of yards of net in Miss Murdstone's cap, or of the price of Mr. Murdstone's dressing gown, or any such ridiculous problem that I have no business with and don't want to have anything at all to do with. Mr. Murdstone makes a movement of impatience, which I've been expecting for a long time. Miss Murdstone does the same. My mother glances submissively at them, shuts the book, and lays it by as an arrear to be worked out when my other tasks are done. There is a pile of these arrears very soon, and it swells like a rolling snowball. The bigger it gets, the more stupid I get. The case is so hopeless, and I feel that I'm wallowing in such a bog of nonsense, that I give up all idea of getting out and abandon myself to my fate. The despairing way in which my mother and I look at each other as I blunder on is truly melancholy. But the greatest effect in these miserable lessons is when my mother, thinking nobody is observing her, tries to give me the clue by the motion of her lips. At that instant, Miss Murdstone, who has been lying in wait for nothing else all along, says in a deep, warning voice, "Clara!" My mother starts, colours, and smiles faintly. Mr. Murdstone comes out of his chair, takes the book, throws it at me or boxes my ears with it, and turns me out of the room by the shoulders. Even when the lessons are done, the worst is yet to happen, in the shape of an appalling sum. This is invented for me, and delivered to me orally by Mr. Murdstone, and begins, "If I go into a cheesemonger's shop and buy 5,000 double Gloucester cheeses at 4d. each, present payment," at which I see Miss Murdstone secretly overjoyed. I pore over these cheeses without any result or enlightenment until dinner time, when, having made a mulatto of myself by getting the dirt of the slate into the pores of my skin, I have a slice of bread to help me out with the cheeses, and am considered in disgrace for the rest of the evening. It seems to me, at this distance of time, as if my unfortunate studies generally took this course. I could have done very well if I'd been without the Murdstones. But the influence of the Murdstones upon me was like the fascination of two snakes on a wretched young bird. Even when I did get through the morning with tolerable credit, there wasn't much gain but dinner. For Miss Murdstone never could endure to see me untasked, and if I rashly made any show of being unemployed, called her brother's attention to me by saying, "Clara, my dear, there's nothing like work. Give your boy an exercise." Which caused me to be clapped down to some new labour, there and then. As to any recreation with other children of my age, I had very little of that. For the gloomy theology of the Murdstones made all children out to be a swarm of little vipers. Though there was a child once set in the midst of the disciples, and held that they contaminated one another. The natural result of this treatment, continued, I suppose, for some 6 months or more, was to make me sullen, dull, and dogged. I was not made the less so by my sense of being daily more and more shut out and alienated from my mother. I believe I should have been almost stupefied but for one circumstance. It was this. My father had left in a little room upstairs to which I had access, for it adjoined my own, a small collection of books which nobody else in our house ever troubled. From that blessed little room, Roderick Random, Peregrine Pickle, Humphrey Clinker, Tom Jones, the Vicar of Wakefield, Don Quixote, Gil Blas, and Robinson Crusoe came out, a glorious host to keep me company. They kept alive my fancy and my hope of something beyond that place and time. They, and the Arabian Nights, and the Tales of the Genii, and did me no harm. For whatever harm was in some of them was not there for me. I knew nothing of it. It's astonishing to me now how I found time, in the midst of my porings and blunderings over heavier themes, to read those books as I did. It's curious to me how I could ever have consoled myself under my small troubles, which were great troubles to me, by impersonating my favourite characters in them, as I did, and by putting Mr. and Miss Murdstone into all the bad ones, which I did too. I have been Tom Jones, a child's Tom Jones, a harmless creature, for a week together. I have sustained my own idea of Roderick Random for a month at a stretch, I verily believe. I had a greedy relish for a few volumes of Voyages and Travels, I forget what now, that were on those shelves. And for days and days I can remember to have gone about my region of our house armed with the centrepiece out of an old set of boot trees, the perfect realization of Captain Somebody of the Royal British Navy, in danger of being beset by savages and resolved to sell his life at a great price. The captain never lost dignity from having his ears boxed with the Latin grammar. I did. But the captain was a captain and a hero, in despite of all the grammars of all the languages in the world, dead or alive. This was my only and my constant comfort. When I think of it, the picture always rises in my mind of a summer evening, the boys at play in the churchyard, and I, sitting on my bed, reading, as if for life. Every barn in the neighbourhood, every stone in the church, and every foot of the churchyard had some association of its own in my mind, connected with these books, and stood for some locality made famous in them. I've seen Tom Pipes go climbing up the church steeple. I've watched Strap with the knapsack on his back stopping to rest himself upon the wicker gate. And I know that Commodore Trunnion held that club with Mr. Pickle in the parlour of our little village alehouse. The reader now understands as well as I do what I was when I came to that point of my youthful history to which I am now coming again.
This ends side two of cassette two of David Copperfield. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 3. David Copperfield, cassette 3.
One morning, when I went into the parlour with my books. I found my mother looking anxious, Miss Murdstone looking firm, and Mr. Murdstone binding something round the bottom of a cane. A lithe and limber cane, which he left off binding when I came in, and poised and switched in the air. "I tell you, Clara," said Mr. Murdstone, "I have been often flogged myself." "To be sure, of course," said Miss Murdstone.
"Certainly, my dear Jane,"
faltered my mother meekly,
But do you think it did Edward good?"
"Do you think it did Edward harm, Clara?"
asked Mr. Murdstone gravely.
"That's the point," said his sister.
To this my mother returned, "Certainly, my dear Jane," and said no more. I felt an apprehension that I was personally interested in this dialogue, and sought Mr. Murdstone's eye as it lighted on mine.
"Now, David," he said,
and I saw that cast again as he said it,
"you must be far more careful today than usual."
He gave the cane another poise and another switch, and having finished his preparation of it, laid it down beside him with an expressive look and took up his book. This was a good freshener to my presence of mind as a beginning. I felt the words of my lessons slipping off not one by one, or line by line, but by the entire page. I tried to lay hold of them, but they seemed, if I may so express it, to have put skates on and to skim away from me with a smoothness there was no checking. We began badly and went on worse. I had come in with an idea of distinguishing myself, rather, conceiving that I was very well prepared, but it turned out to be quite a mistake. Book after book was added to the heap of failures, Miss Murdstone being firmly watchful of us all the time, and when we came at last to the 5,000 cheeses, canes, he made it that day, I remember, my mother burst out crying. "Clara," said Miss Murdstone in her warning voice.
"I'm not quite well, my dear Jane, I think,"
said my mother.
I saw him wink solemnly at his sister as he rose and said, taking up the cane, "Why, Jane, we can hardly expect Clara to bear with perfect firmness the worry and torment that David has occasioned her today. That would be hysterical. Clara is greatly strengthened and improved, but we can hardly expect so much from her. David, you and I will go upstairs, boy."
As he took me out at the door, my mother ran towards us. Miss Murdstone said, "Clara, are you a perfect fool?" and interfered. I saw my mother stop her ears then, and I heard her crying. He walked me up to my room slowly and gravely. I'm certain he had a delight in that formal parade of executing justice. And when we got there, suddenly twisted my head under his arm.
"Mr. Murdstone, sir," I cried to him, "don't, pray don't beat me. I tried to learn, sir, but I can't learn when you and Miss Murdstone are by. I can't indeed." "Can't you indeed, David," he said. "We'll try that."
He had my head as in a vice, but I twined round him somehow and stopped him for a moment, entreating him not to beat me. It was only for a moment that I stopped him, for he cut me heavily an instant afterwards, and in the same instant I caught the hand with which he held me in my mouth, between my teeth, and bit it through. It sets my teeth on edge to think of it. He beat me then as if he would have beaten me to death. Above all the noise we made, I heard them running up the stairs and crying out. I heard my mother crying out, and Peggotty. Then he was gone, and the door was locked outside. And I was lying, fevered and hot and torn and sore, and raging in my puny way upon the floor. How well I recollect, when I became quiet, what an unnatural stillness seemed to reign through the whole house. How well I remember when my smart and passion began to cool, how wicked I began to feel. I sat listening for a long while but there wasn't a sound. I crawled up from the floor and saw my face in the glass, so swollen, red and ugly, that it almost frightened me. My stripes were sore and stiff and made me cry afresh when I moved, but they were nothing to the guilt I felt. It lay heavier on my breast than if I'd been a most atrocious criminal, I dare say. It had begun to grow dark, and I'd shut the window. I'd been lying for the most part with my head upon the sill, by turns crying, dozing, and looking listlessly out, when the key was turned, and Miss Murdstone came in with some bread and meat and milk. These she put down upon the table without a word, glaring at me the while with exemplary firmness, and then retired, locking the door after her. Long after it was dark, I sat there, wondering whether anybody else would come. When this appeared improbable for that night, I undressed and went to bed. And there, I began to wonder fearfully what would be done to me. Whether it was a criminal act that I had committed, whether I should be taken into custody and sent to prison, whether I was at all in danger of being hanged. I never shall forget the waking next morning. The being cheerful and fresh for the first moment, and then the being weighed down by the stale and dismal oppression of remembrance. Miss Murdstone reappeared before I was out of bed, told me in so many words that I was free to walk in the garden for half an hour and no longer, and retired, leaving the door open that I might avail myself of that permission. I did so, and did so every morning of my imprisonment, which lasted 5 days. If I could have seen my mother alone, I should have gone down on my knees to her and besought her forgiveness. But I saw no one, Miss Murdstone excepted, during the whole time, except at evening prayers in the parlour, to which I was escorted by Miss Murdstone after everybody else was placed, where I was stationed, a young outlaw, all alone by myself near the door, and whence I was solemnly conducted by my jailer before anyone arose from the devotional posture. I only observed that my mother was as far off from me as she could be, and kept her face another way so that I never saw it, and that Mr. Murdstone's hand was bound up in a large linen wrapper. The length of those 5 days I can convey no idea of to anyone. They occupy the place of years in my remembrance. The way in which I listened to all the incidents of the house that made themselves audible to me, the ringing of bells, the opening and shutting of doors, the murmuring of voices, the footsteps on the stairs, to any laughing, whistling, or singing outside which seemed more dismal than anything else to me in my solitude and disgrace, the uncertain pace of the hours, especially at night, when I would wake thinking it was morning, and find that the family were not yet gone to bed, and that all the length of night had yet to come, the depressed dreams and nightmares I had, the return of day, noon, afternoon, evening, when the boys played in the churchyard, and I watched them from a distance within the room, being ashamed to show myself at the window lest they should know I was a prisoner. The strange sensation of never hearing myself speak. The fleeting intervals of something like cheerfulness which came with eating and drinking and went away with it. The setting in of rain one evening with a fresh smell, and it's coming down faster and faster between me and the church, until it and gathering night seem to quench me in gloom and fear and remorse. All this appears to have gone round and round for years instead of days. It's so vividly and strongly stamped on my remembrance. On the last night of my restraint, I was awakened by hearing my own name spoken in a whisper. I started up in bed, and putting out my arms in the dark, said, "Is that you, Peggotty?" There was no immediate answer, but presently I heard my name again, in a tone so very mysterious and awful that I think I should have gone into a fit if it hadn't occurred to me that it must have come through the keyhole. I groped my way to the door, and putting my own lips to the keyhole, whispered, "Is that you, Peggotty dear?"
"Yes, my own precious Davy,"
she replied.
"Be as soft as a mouse, or the cat'll hear us."
I understood this to mean Miss Murdstone, and was sensible of the urgency of the case, her room being close by.
"How's Mama, dear Peggotty? Is she very angry with me?"
I could hear Peggotty crying softly on her side of the keyhole, as I was doing on mine, before she answered,
"No, not very."
"What's going to be done with me, Peggotty, dear? Do you know?"
"School. New London," was Peggotty's answer.
I was obliged to get her to repeat it, for she spoke it the first time quite down my throat in consequence of my having forgotten to take my mouth away from the keyhole and put my ear there. And though her words tickled me a good deal, I didn't hear them.
"When, Peggotty?"
"Tomorrow."
"Is that the reason why Miss Murdstone took the clothes out of my drawers?"
"Which she had done, though I've forgotten to mention it."
"Yes," said Peggotty. "Box."
"Shan't I see Mama?"
"Yes," said Peggotty. "Morning."
Then Peggotty fitted her mouth close to the keyhole, and delivered these words through it with as much feeling and earnestness as a keyhole has ever been the medium of communicating, I'll venture to assert, shooting in each broken little sentence in a convulsive little burst of its own.
"Davy, dear,
if I ain't been exactly as intimate with you lately as I used to be, it ain't because I don't love you just as well and more, my pretty poppet. It's because I thought it better for you, and for someone else besides. Davy, my darling, are you listening? Can you hear me?"
"Yes, Peggotty," I sobbed.
"My own,"
said Peggotty with infinite compassion,
"what I want to say is that you must never forget me, for I'll never forget you. And I'll take as much care of your Mama, Davy, as ever I took of you. And I won't leave her. The day may come when she'll be glad to lay her poor head on her stupid cross old Peggotty's arm again. And I'll write to you, my dear, though I ain't no scholar. And I'll...
Peggotty fell to kissing the keyhole as she couldn't kiss me.
"Thank you, dear Peggotty,"
said I.
"Oh, thank you, thank you. Will you promise me one thing, Peggotty? Will you write and tell Mr. Peggotty and little Emily and Mrs. Gummidge and Ham that I'm not as bad as they might suppose, and that I send them all my love, especially to little Emily? Will you, if you please, Peggotty?"
The kind soul promised, and we both of us kissed the keyhole with the greatest affection. I patted it with my hand, I recollect, as if it had been her honest face, and parted. From that night there grew up in my breast a feeling for Peggotty which I cannot very well define. She didn't replace my mother, no one could do that, but she came into a vacancy in my heart which closed upon her, and I felt towards her something I have never felt for any other human being. It was a sort of comical affection, too, and yet if she had died, I cannot think what I should have done, or how I should have acted out the tragedy it would have been to me. In the morning, Miss Murdstone appeared as usual and told me I was going to school, which was not altogether such news to me as she supposed. She also informed me that when I was dressed I was to come downstairs into the parlour and have my breakfast. There I found my mother, very pale and with red eyes, into whose arms I ran and begged her pardon from my suffering soul. "Oh, Davy," she said, "that you could hurt anyone I love. Try to be better, pray to be better. I forgive you. But I am so grieved, Davy, that you should have had such bad passions in your heart." They had persuaded her that I was a wicked fellow, and she was more sorry for that than for my going away. I felt it sorely. I tried to eat my parting breakfast, but my tears dropped upon my bread and butter and trickled into my tea. I saw my mother look at me sometimes, and then glance at the watchful Miss Murdstone, and then look down, or look away. "Master Copperfield's box there," said Miss Murdstone, when wheels were heard at the gate. I looked for Peggotty, but it was not she. Neither she nor Mr. Murdstone appeared. My former acquaintance, the carrier, was at the door. The box was taken out to his cart and lifted in. "Clara," said Miss Murdstone in her warning note. "Ready, my dear Jane," returned my mother. "Goodbye, Davy. You're going for your own good. Goodbye, my child. You will come home in the holidays and be a better boy."
"Clara," Miss Murdstone repeated.
"Certainly, my dear Jane,"
replied my mother, who was holding me.
"I forgive you, my dear boy. God bless you."
"Clara,"
Miss Murdstone repeated. Miss Murdstone was good enough to take me out to the cart and to say on the way that she hoped I would repent before I came to a bad end. And then I got into the cart, and the lazy horse walked off with it. Chapter 5. I Am Sent Away From Home. We might have gone about half a mile, and my pocket handkerchief was quite wet through, when the carrier stopped short. Looking out to ascertain what for, I saw, to my amazement, Peggotty burst from the hedge and climb into the cart. She took me in both her arms and squeezed me to her stays until the pressure on my nose was extremely painful, though I never thought of that till afterwards when I found it very tender. Not a single word did Peggotty speak. Releasing one of her arms, she put it down in her pocket to the elbow and brought out some paper bags of cakes, which she crammed into my pockets, and a purse which she put into my hand, but not one word did she say. After another and a final squeeze with both arms, she got down from the cart and ran away. And my belief is, and has always been, without a solitary button on her gown. I picked up one of several that were rolling about and treasured it as a keepsake for a long time. The carrier looked at me as if to inquire if she were coming back. I shook my head and said I thought not. "Then come up," said the carrier to the lazy horse, who came up accordingly. Having by this time cried as much as I possibly could, I began to think it was of no use crying any more, especially as neither Roderick Random nor that captain in the Royal British Navy had ever cried, that I could remember, in trying situations. The carrier, seeing me in this resolution, proposed that my pocket handkerchief should be spread upon the horse's back to dry. I thanked him and assented, and particularly small it looked under those circumstances. I had now leisure to examine the purse. It was a stiff leather purse with a snap, and had 3 bright shillings in it, which Peggotty had evidently polished up with whitening for my greater delight. But its most precious contents were 2 half-crowns folded together in a bit of paper, on which was written in my mother's hand, "For Davy, with my love." I was so overcome by this that I asked the carrier to be so good as to reach me my pocket handkerchief again, but he said he thought I'd better do without it. and I thought I really had, so I wiped my eyes on my sleeve and stopped myself. For good, too. Though in consequence of my previous emotions I was still occasionally seized with a stormy sob. After we jogged on for some little time, I asked the carrier if he was going all the way. "All the way where?" inquired the carrier. "There," I said. "Where's there?" inquired the carrier. "Near London," I said. "Why, that horse," said the carrier, jerking the rein to point him out, "would be deader than pork afore he got over half the ground." "Are you only going to Yarmouth, then?" I asked. "That's about it," said the carrier, "and there I shall take you to the stagecoach, and the stagecoach that will take you to wherever it is." As this was a great deal for the carrier, whose name was Mr. Barkis, to say, he being, as I observed in a former chapter, of a phlegmatic temperament and not at all conversational, I offered him a cake as a mark of attention, which he ate at one gulp exactly like an elephant, and which made no more impression on his big face than it would have done on an elephant's. "Did she make 'em now?" said Mr. Barkis, always leaning forward in his slouching way on the footboard of the cart, with an arm on each knee. "Peggotty, do you mean, sir?"
"Ah," said Mr. Barkis. "Her."
"Yes, she makes all our pastry and does all our cooking."
"Do she, though?"
said Mr. Barkis. He made up his mouth as if to whistle, but he didn't whistle. He sat looking at the horse's ears, as if he saw something new there, and sat so for a considerable time. By and by he said,
"No sweethearts, I believe."
"Sweetmeats, did you say, Mr. Barkis?" For I thought he wanted something else to eat, and had pointedly alluded to that description of refreshment.
"Hearts," said Mr. Barkis. "Sweet hearts. No person walks with her."
"With Peggotty?"
"Ah," he said. "Her."
"Oh, no, she never had a sweetheart."
"Didn't she, though?"
said Mr. Barkis. Again he made up his mouth to whistle, and again he didn't whistle, but sat looking at the horse's ears.
"So she makes,"
said Mr. Barkis after a long interval of reflection,
"all the apple pasties and does all the cooking, do she?"
I replied that such was the fact.
"Well, I'll tell you what," said Mr. Barkis. "Perhaps you might be writing to her."
"I shall certainly write to her," I rejoined.
"Ah,"
he said, slowly turning his eyes towards me.
"Well, if you was writing to her, perhaps you'd recollect to say that Barkis was willing, would you?"
"That Barkis is willing," I repeated innocently. "Is that all the message?"
"Yes,"
he said, considering.
"Yes, Barkis is willing.
But you'll be at Blunderstone again tomorrow, Mr. Barkis," I said, faltering a little at the idea of my being far away from it then, "and could give your own message so much better." As he repudiated the suggestion, however, with a jerk of his head, and once more confirmed his previous request by saying with profound gravity,
"Barkis is willing. That's the message,"
I readily undertook its transmission. While I was waiting for the coach in the hotel at Yarmouth that very afternoon, I procured a sheet of paper and an inkstand and wrote a note to Peggotty, which ran thus: "My dear Peggotty, I have come here safe. Barkis is willing. My love to Mama. Yours affectionately. P.S. He says he particularly wants you to know Barkis is willing." When I'd taken this commission on myself prospectively, Mr. Barkis relapsed into perfect silence. And I, feeling quite worn out by all that had happened lately, lay down on a sack in the cart and fell asleep. I slept soundly until we got to Yarmouth, which was so entirely new and strange to me in the inn yard to which we drove